Mr. Vice President, good morning. Thank you. We're sorry we couldn't have ordered better weather for you when you were here in Sioux City last Friday. And we appreciate you giving us another shot at this.
No. We tried to get in. We sat in Houston Houston for a long time.
Well, it was typical January weather in Iowa. But we appreciate the fact you carved out some time for us today to make up for that.
Important.
I want to start with this, sir.
Sure.
I want to ask a question that became rather infamous when Roger Mudd asked Ted Kennedy in 1979. And I want to frame it this way to you. After more than 40 years of public service and at an age and time in your life when you easily could have continued to enjoy life after Washington, why did you decide to run for president again? Why do you want to be president? And why are you the best option for Democrats?
You got an hour?
No, we do, actually. Do you?
Well, let's start off with the first part.
Uh-huh.
I'll be blunt with you. I had not planned on running again. I had planned on running in 16, and I had already put together a staff that was a core staff in my vice president's office and beyond to try to get the nomination in 16, because I thought that we had spent the first 5 years keeping the car from going over the cliff, and we were just getting it back out, not off the cliff, but also out of the ditch. We had some new tires on it. We were redoing the engine. Things were beginning to move. And I thought we'd then be able to focus on the thing that, when I talked to the president, when Obama, when he asked me to be vice president, I asked him a question. He said, "Do you have anything?" I said, "I have one question. Do you mean what you say about restoring the middle class?" And he said, "Yes. All we did was restore some sanity in our international and national economy." But what happened was, when my son came home from Iraq, shortly after he got home, they initially diagnosed him with having had a stroke. But later we went down to MD Anderson, and they concluded he had a terminal cancer disease, stage 4 glioblastoma. He made me promise me, and I mean this sincerely, he made me promise him I wouldn't let anybody know that it was terminal, because he wanted to finish his term as Attorney General of the state of Delaware. And so I was unable to tell anybody that I wasn't going to run, because had I said that, everybody would have known it was terminal. And so when he did pass, there was still some push for me to get into the race, that's when I walked out with President Obama out in the Rose Garden and said I wasn't going to run. And I worked like the devil. I did 84 events for Hillary, because I thought she would have been a much better president than our present president. And I had become a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was able to bring along with me, and at Delaware, University of Delaware, they named the school after me down there, their public policy school. And I was able to hire the very people I would have brought with me had I gotten elected as as president in 16, doing foreign policy at Penn and doing domestic policy and tax policy at Delaware. And I was satisfied. But what happened then was I thought that, and I mean this sincerely from the bottom of my heart, when I saw those folks coming out of the fields carrying torches in down in Virginia and Charlottesville and chanting that same anti-Semitic bile, the same exact bile that was chanted in the 30s and the late 20s in Europe and in Germany in particular. And then the president, when that young woman was killed, saying there are very fine people on both sides, that just crystallized for me that this whole policy of division that the president has been working on, separating people based on their race, their ethnicity, Muslim bans, talking about when he came down the escalator that we're going to get rid of all those Mexican rapists, the way he demonizes people of color and the rest. I come out of the civil rights movement as a kid in Delaware, and I thought that we got to do something. But then I'm being completely honest with you. I probably shouldn't tell you the whole thing, but what the hell, I've said it other places. What happened was I knew this would be a very ugly campaign. I know what the I know the Giulianis of the world. He's never forgiven me for saying he's a noun, a verb, a 9/11. Now he's a noun, a verb, a corruption. But I knew what would happen, and I was asked by my. We have a tradition in our family for real. You can ask anybody in either party who known me for years that any child in my family can call for a family meeting, and it's taken seriously. And so my granddaughter, who's now a senior in law school, and my four granddaughters and grandson, they asked to have a family meeting. That was on a Wednesday, and on a Sunday we met with their Nana, my wife, and I. And they went through about why, quote, daddy would want you to run, and my dad wants you to run, and we know it's going to be dirty pop and so on and so forth. And they gave me examples of things that are already they were already sensing and being said indirectly. But you got to run. And so I thought long and hard about it, and I'll be blunt with you. The things that I think have to be done that are most badly needed to be done right now for the country fall in my wheelhouse, things I've done my whole life. I think it's critically important that we restore a sense of decency and honor, not just to the presidency, but across the board. I mean, think about how people talk to one another now. Think about how many times there's a guy cleaning out the storm drain after a major storm here in Iowa. How many people walk outside and thank him for cleaning the drain to keep their basement from flooding? And our children are listening to all this. And so part of it was that. The second part was I really think that the next president is going to have to do, we're going to inherit two things, a badly divided nation and a world in disarray. And I know you may recall, because you've covered it, I've been roundly criticized in the beginning by the people seeking the nomination. I talk about having to unite the country. And they say, I'm naive. I find it interesting. I'm the old guy and I'm naive. They usually don't go together. But and they point out, yeah, Biden was able to put together big compromises with Republicans over the years and so on and so forth, but he doesn't understand this new Republican Party. Well, I understand this new Republican Party. I understand what it's done. I mean, look, I've been the victim of their affection for a while now. They've gone after my only surviving son in a way that is just miserable and mean. They've even gone back, and I don't care about it, but I mean, the idea, talk about decency, making fun of the fact that I used to stutter. I mean, come on, this is, and our kids are listening to all of this stuff. And so I just decided that I was going to take a shot at it because I think I can do two things. I think, and I'll conclude with it, probably giving you more than you ever wanted to know, but no one's ever accused me of not saying what I think. The problem is I sometimes say all that I think. And so what happened is that I think that the president, the next president of the United States, is going to have to, on January the 21st, 2021, assume the world stage and be able to command the world stage. I've met every major world leader in the last 40 years. I know the vast majority of the present leaders by their first names. I've spent more time with Xi Jinping than any other world leader before, at least as of the time we left. Spent an awful lot of time with Putin. I know him. He knows me, and he knows I know him. So I think you got to be ready to be able on day one to say to the world and our allies, America's back. You can take America's word for what I say. We will do what we say. And I will rebuild our alliances. And before, I'll conclude by saying, before I announce for president, I would go abroad and speak as a professor from the University of Pennsylvania in their on their international school, and it's not actually in the Biden school, they call it. Anyway. And I would be importuned by world leaders. And when they came to visit Trump, they'd call me and ask me what in the hell is going on, existing heads of state, and asked to speak to, like the Munich conference, where all the heads of state of our NATO allies meet and our national security advisors, et cetera. And they don't know what the hell's going on here. They wonder what's happening. This embrace of thugs and dictators and oligarchs. poking our finger in the eye of our allies, walking away from the Kurds. Anyway, so there are two things. I think I am, be very blunt about it, better equipped than anybody in either party on day one to try to put our international interests back together and to work with Republicans to get things done.
Several follow-ups, of course, and a lot to chew on there and to ask you about in more specifics. I want to start with this follow-up. You've talked about that this election is a battle for America's soul. I presume that part of that is the decency aspect you were just talking about. How, maybe go into a little more detail on how this is, in fact, a battle for America's soul, and how does the President of the United States, how can the President of the United States improve the overall level of dialogue in our country and bring some decency to that dialogue? How can he or she do that?
The American president is the most consequential person in the United States of America about dealing with decency. Words of a president matter. A president can send brave women and men to war, can bring peace. A president can, in fact, generate a sense of what we stand for, we the people, or I know it sounds corny, but it's real. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It can set a tone about what is appropriate and inappropriate in the way to speak to people, and the way to speak about people, and the way to speak about our allies. And the president can also breathe oxygen to those folks who are come out from under the rocks. The history of America is not a fairy tale. And a guy who interviewed me when I was doing my book tour in a whole bunch of different cities, wrote the book, The Soul of America, and John Meacham, who'd become a friend. And John talks about the fact that it's not a fairy tale. There are elements that always existed in America that are prejudiced, hate-filled. They've always existed. They don't represent anywhere near a majority of the American people. If you've read his book, if you haven't, I'd strongly recommend it to you, by the way. And he talks about how, and I think it's in about page 100 or so, there's a picture of over 3,000 people coming, walking down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington in their pointed hats and hoods and masks, and the Ku Klux Klan, I think it was 35 or 36 House members, this is in 1924, were active members of the Ku Klux Klan as six or seven senators, et cetera. And he talks about when that occurs, it's always occurred. We've gone through these periods in American history. And when it occurs, the only way you can stomp it out is presidents have to stand up. All faith leaders have to stand up, and both parties have to stand up and say, enough is enough. Look what's happening to us around the world. Not a joke. Think about this. No matter whether you like Trump or don't like Trump, look at how our reputation has been so badly sullied. Look, we've always led the world not by just the example of our power, but the power of our example. And now, if you look at the polling data that was done back in, I guess it was March or February of last year, rating, and I forget who it was. I think it was Bloomberg. I can't remember. One of the major polling operations did it, and I think it was in October. I think it was a Gallup, but I'm not positive. And they asked to rate the world leaders as the ones with most they respect the most. This president rated, meaning America rated, below Xi Jinping in China and just above Vladimir Putin. And that has profound impacts on us in terms of everything from trade to being able to put together unofficial alliances. Look, the next president is going to be faced with, unless we have allies and people who follow us. And again, think, I'm not joking when I say it's not just the example of our power. It's been the power of our example that's forced the world to stay with us. That's what put things together. But look what's happening now. If, in fact, unless we are able to put together coalitions to deal with stateless actors and failed states, and I helped put one together for 63, I think, to deal with the ISIS and the caliphate, we end up being the world's policemen again. Because the greatest threat from those agents, though those operations, are the United States of America. We are the target. And so we have to be able to reestablish that we have some, there's some relationship to being what we say we are, what we believe ourselves to be, that we treat people with dignity, and the reality of that. And I know you may think that's corny, but it is a fact. I believe it's a fact. It's a historical fact. And so, look, when you have a president of the United States stand up, and I know Putin well. We've had our come-to-Jesus meeting, as they say, in southern Delaware. And I've met with him alone on more than one occasion for extended periods of time. When we, in fact, the president of the United States stands up before the whole world at a G20 meeting at the time, and says that he, why would Vladimir Putin interfere in our election? Why would he do that? After 19 intelligence agencies, and I know this because I was still running part of the intelligence operation at the time as vice president, and everyone pointed out that he directly interfered, attempt to interfere in our election. What do you think that does with the intelligence communities and our European allies as to whether or not they're going to count on, whether they're going to completely level with, whether they're going to accept the word of the United States of America? It is like, it's just sort of like breaking up the plaster that holds us together.
Well, and I was going to ask you a follow-up about Mr. Putin and ask you for, and I'll just ask you now since you're talking about him, what is your overall assessment of him? How would you deal with him? As you alluded to, President Trump gets criticism for cozying up to him too much. What would a President Biden's approach be to Mr. Putin and to Russia?
Make it really clear that we are not going to tolerate his... He has one goal, in my view, and I was the one, you may recall, in our administration that argued that we have to respond, and Europe has to respond, as uncomfortable it is, to his attempt to literally destabilize NATO and, in fact, destabilize Eastern Europe. The one thing he wants to do, they do not have the economic power or any stretch of the imagination to compete with us, and the only thing they have is military power that's regionally capable and internationally in terms of their missiles and what the thing they want most is the way he can keep his kleptocracy going is if he's able to diminish and break up NATO. Look what's happening in Romania now. Look what's happening in Moldova. Look what's happening in Hungary with Orbán. Look what's happening across Europe. It's all designed to have NATO weakened. So, because he'd much rather deal with 28 different nations than deal with any one nation. And so what I would talk about with him, and I did talk about with him, is they have to understand if, in fact, they are going to move in an aggressive way, we're going to organize the rest of the world to push back, as we did push back with him on the Crimea. You know, the fact is that there's a severe financial situation in Russia, and it continues to persist. So I'd give states resources that they're pleading for to replace old equipment and secure elections in the United States of America. I'd put an end to the dark money in politics, so we know who's behind the ads. I'd insist that social media companies take action to stop the misuse of their platforms of distortions. And I'd stop doing Russia's bidding by attacking our institutions and dividing America from one another. Look, last year, you know, I helped write a pledge. I joined a group of international leaders in the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity and in Europe, and the former head of the NATO and a former prime minister, and getting everyone in Europe to take a pledge that we, in fact, would none of the leaders running for election in their last round of elections would, in fact, seek or solicit foreign interference, that they would not, they'd forswear from using disinformation in campaigns. They actually stood up and took a pledge, because that's how he undermines us. He undermines us in large part, not just by the threat, what's going on in the Donbas right now, where Ukrainians are being killed as I speak by, quote, green men without patches on their uniforms that are Russians, but also by insisting that democracies are failing. Democracies can't function. Democracies are a joke. Democracies are not. And particularly when we're in a position that the world's in transition here in ways that I'm getting too far off for you. This is more like a seminar. I apologize. But the bottom line is that I think if you take a look at it, you know, and you make a and you focus, we're in a position now where, you know, we're in the midst of a fourth industrial revolution here. The question is there going to be a middle class? Are we going to be able to hold together democratic institutions? One of the things that's going on, the most difficult speech I ever had to make, I made a speech where actually Trump is right now in Davos several years ago, and I was asked by Klaus Schwab, the head of the Fora, would I make a speech on the fourth industrial revolution? Will there be a middle class? And it is a question. We're going through a serious transition in technology that is going to fundamentally change the way in which we are able to respond democratically to make sure that it does, that it benefits everybody, not just a few people. This is occurring at a moment when the rest of the world, our lack of leadership, our lack of moral leadership, our lack of political leadership in the world, is occurring at a moment when the world is in self-doubt about whether or not autocracies and or democracies are best suited to deal with the changes in the 21st century. And that I know I'm getting a little esoteric here, but I really mean it. I think that's why it's so important that the United States is engaged in making clear that there are certain basic principles that we've not always lived up to, but that are necessary to generate democratic movement.
Well, let's move back to domestic issues for a couple of questions.
If I'm giving you more than you want, please cut me off because I'm beginning to bore myself.
Let's move back home, as I said, for a couple of domestic issue-related questions. If this isn't the biggest domestic issue, it's near the top, and that's health care, of course. Your administration created the Affordable Care Act, and there's a lot of discussion about should we scrap the ACA, should we build upon the ACA, should we have a public option, should we have a single-payer system. I know your position is more, of course, since the ACA came from your administration, to build upon it and to create a public option. Kind of assess for us what you think the shortcomings are of the ACA and how your plan for health care would address those and why building upon what you started is the best route.
The shortcomings of the ACA are we were not able to add a public option. That's the biggest shortcoming. And what happened was when states like yours privatized Medicaid, we left out, you know, tens of thousands of people here and across the country. And so you had an awful lot of poor people, folks who couldn't afford to buy in to the system, or when they bought in, they did not get the coverage that they needed, were left out. And you may recall a very brief history of this is that when we passed the ACA, what happened was that we lost the House right after that. And everyone, including Democrats, attributed the loss to the ACA, what do we do, et cetera. That's why we lost. You may recall one of the Biden gaffes was I said to the president after the ACA was passed, he should have a fireside chat. Everybody started laughing. You know, what I meant was he should go on air and take time to explain to the American public what we had just done and how it worked. Because healthcare, you know, I always joke with people, I'm supposedly an expert on foreign policy. You want to do something complicated, deal with healthcare. It's a hell of a lot more complicated than foreign policy. And so the president said, no, we don't have time to take a victory lap, Joe, and we got so much more on the table, we can't do it. So we ended up losing. And then what happened was, here in this state and a lot of other places across the country, there was a full-blown broadside attack on the ACA, get rid of it. The president went to court to eliminate it, et cetera, and a lot of changes were made in it. And everybody said, well, you know, that's what the American people want. And in 2018, I went into 24 states, and I campaigned for over 65 candidates. And we ran directly against, I supported candidates, not Democrats in those states, who were supporters of the ACA and took on the Republicans who were saying they wanted to do away with it. And guess what? We won back the House. You may remember I got criticized, understandably, for saying we'd win back 41 seats. We won back 41 seats from Republicans. You didn't hear any Republicans running around saying they want to do away with covering pre-existing conditions. I want to kick your kid off your health care policy and can't stay till age 26. The 20 million people we put on health care for the first time, we want to get rid of them. And so what happened was when people realized what was being taken away, it's the first time they realized, oh, that's Obamacare. They didn't really understand it because it's complicated. And so what I think is that we're at a point now where the vast majority of America, including Republicans living in the neighborhood, independents in the neighborhood, they think health care should be a right, not just a privilege. Everyone should have access to affordable health care. That's a gigantic change that's taken place. I almost lost an election in 1972 as a young kid running for the Senate because I said health care should be a right. Education is a right, so should health care be. But here's the deal. What happened was now people are saying, okay, what do we do? Well, I put forward a plan. And in fact, provides for a public option, significantly reduces and puts a lid on drug prices, and makes available for anyone who qualifies for Medicaid would automatically be enrolled in a public option, Medicare-like option. But it is affordable and it is doable. Now, it costs a lot of money. My plan cost over $750 billion over 10 years. That's a lot of money. But I lay out how I would pay for that plan, and it will put and it doesn't have to wait 5, 10 years or whatever the Medicare for All guys are saying these days. It can be instituted immediately. It can be moved because I'm confident the public is at a different place than they were just several years ago, and the way I pay for it is. I'd be happy to send you to my pay-for plan about how I deal with capital gains, corporate tax rates, stepped-up basis, cap on deductions, sanctions on tax avoidance, et cetera. And I start off by not paying for anything with a wealth tax. I want to make the system function. I want to change the healthcare system, change the tax system to make it fair. And I know I get criticized when I say to, and from the time every fundraiser I've ever had, I've allowed the public, the press in. They've covered every fundraiser I've ever had from the beginning. And I say to the wealthy people who may be in the room, if there are, I say, look.
We're journalists.
Well, no, I know that. But my point is, I get criticized for saying the following. That, in fact, this is not going to punish you. You're still going to be able to have your two homes, but you're going to start paying your fair share. And so, for example, which I was able to do in a compromise with the man everybody says you can't compromise, the majority, present majority leader from Kentucky, I raised the top rate to 39.6% again. That raises $90 billion, and I make sure that, in fact, the deductions for everyone at 28%, so that if you make a charitable contribution, for example, and you're at the 39.6% top rate, you don't get to deduct 39.6%. You get to deduct 28%. That's the maximum level everyone can. That raises that all by itself raises another $310 billion. And so my point is that there's ways to pay for this that in fact can reduce the deficit at the same time. And because I really do think that to walk away from the notion that we've increased the debt by $1.9 trillion and say, don't worry about it, is absolutely foolhardy. absolutely foolhardy.
And that actually was going to be my next question, was the federal debt, and it stands at $20 trillion, and we run deficit budgets every year. And yep. I hear a lot of Democrats talk about big plans to spend big money for this and for that. How serious do you view federal debt, and how would your administration approach this tsunami of red ink our country is shouldered with today?
Two things. One, it is very serious. But two, it's hard if the economy is moving down, if it's plunging, if it's... Now, I realize that we talk now about how the economy is doing so well. Well, the economy is doing very well for the top 1-3%, and if you have a... and if you're able to be in the market still, it's doing well. But for the 95-96% of the American people, it is doing very poorly. All the data shows that over 44%, I think the number is, of people in the United States of America live on an income that's the equivalent of making something like $9, $10, $12 an hour. They have no room, period, number one. Number two, the cost of their being able to maintain everything from their homes that they own it to deal with debt that they have. The studies also show that if the average middle-class person received a bill for $400 in 1 month they didn't anticipate, they'd have to sell something or borrow the money. There is no sense of certainty on the part of the vast majority of the American people. So what you have to do is you have to deal with this in a way that leads to, how do we hold down the debt? How do we pay for any promises we make? And that's where I am now. Keep the debt from expanding, because it is. Look, this tax cut expanded at $1.9 trillion. $1.9 trillion. One fell swoop. And so the way you, in fact, dealing with the debt is you increase productivity significantly. There's no increase in productivity. According to, the Heritage Foundation, what happened is they point out that this tax cut did not, in fact, in any way significantly change to deal with increasing productivity. And one of the things, and you guys won't like it because you're more conservative paper than most as I read your editorials, the fact is that we have to do something in a way in which corporations deal with investments. I come from the corporate state of the world, Delaware. And here's the deal. I've had actually we're in a position where the Business Roundtable, which is basically comes out of Delaware, the Fortune 500 companies, they came to me at the end of the last year we were in office. And I came to the vice president's residence, headed up by the former governor of Michigan, who was the chair of the operation. And I think it was six of the Fortune top 20 CEOs came to see me, and they said, we need help on changing corporate attitudes. And I looked at them, I said, guys, you're coming to a Democrat vice president to do that? And they said, yes, because we're eating our own seed corn now. You have a study done at the University of Massachusetts where it points out that the corporations from 2004 to 14 made more money than they made in any 10-year period. Yet what they did was they went out and they bought back 56% of their shares. They bought back by the corporation, number one. Number two, they also then had 39% of went to dividends, leaving 9% for every single solitary other thing: research, development, job training, engagement at all. 9%. And it is ridiculous. And so it used to be that we're in a position where you'd see corporations reinvest. It's as if Alan Greenspan is alive and well and running still, things are still moving in that direction. And so now you even have American corporations saying, whoa, we are thinking of short-term too much. One CEO said to me, I go up to New York and I got to go up every quarter or thereabouts, and I have to tell, I won't describe how he described the one person, the person he had to meet with. He said, I got to describe some young person why we're going to have a good quarter. And he said, in order to do that, if I can't do that, then they're going to downgrade me, and I'm going to lose. So he said, I have to cut an entire research element of my operation here. And so it's about just not just dealing with the tax structure. It's about dealing with the way in which corporations work toward expanding. And one of the things to do that is we could go back to the SEC rule that did not allow corporations in the Reagan until Reagan came along and to invest, buy back more than a certain percentage of their stock. Because they had, that gave them the ability to invest back into their corporations. And think about it. When we talk about trade, you know, although Boeing's having its own problems now, well beyond what I'm about to say, but, you know, Boeing had no problem deciding that they were going to sell Boeing aircraft in China, but they had to have a 51% owner and they had to give away the trade secrets. Well, guess what? The average CEO is a six-year tenure. The CEO gets rewarded based on what the stock options are because there's a limitation on what can be deducted from salary out of a direct payment. I mean, it's all kind of backwards right now. And it's not very capitalistically oriented. And I think we have to just change the way we think about these things. And look, you know, I think that, you know, we inherited a huge debt when Barack and I came in office. And by the time we left office, we cut it in half, the deficit in half. And so the first thing you got to do, though, is you got to go out and solidify the economy, strengthen it, make sure it's beginning to work, not by going out and just deciding to cut. We've got to invest to compete. Look what China's doing with G5. Look what China's doing with artificial intelligence. What the hell are we doing? What is the United States of America doing? We have more great research universities in the United States of America than all the rest of the world combined. And every new idea of consequence has come out of one of those universities in the last 20 years, owned by the American public. What are we doing?
Well, you talked about corporate profits, talked about the tax part of it. What about the spending part of it? You're right. This is a conservative part of Iowa, and a lot of our readers say they just spend too much money in Washington, D.C.
Right. Spend too much money the wrong way. Look, if I'm spending money that, in fact, is able to also lower the debt while I am increasing productivity. Let me give you an example. We're in a situation now where, and you guys have covered this thoroughly, that over the last, I guess it's now 20 months or thereabouts, over the last year and a half, maybe a little longer, we have lost in the United States over 220,000 retail jobs. Because all those satellite stores from Saks Fifth Avenue to Benetton's to just to all of them have been closing down. Why? Because of Amazon. Not Amazon, that part's not making Amazon the bad guy. It's new technology. Half of you and me, and especially if you're busy, which you all are, you got your Christmas gifts online. So these stores are closing. Lost over 220,000 jobs, average salary $50,000 a year, average age 49 years of age, and at the same time, you find yourself in a situation where they either the totality of their household's income, or they are half of it, and in fact, they are almost overwhelmingly high school educated people. So what do we do with them? We say, lots of luck in your senior year, man. You're 50 years old. You can't do anything else. You're on your own. No, it makes sense to spend the $6 billion I'm talking about to allow them all, if they qualify, to go back and learn new trade, a new way of being able to make a living in community colleges. And anybody who's qualified for community college is spending $6 billion. That's a lot of money, but a year. But it will fundamentally change the opportunity for people to go out and be productive again. Look, think of what you all have written about, because my staff took the time to put together a lot of editorials and comments. Trump's tariff subsidies cost the American taxpayer $28 billion. $28 billion for the people of New York City and Los Angeles and others who have no interest in agriculture, they don't know about it, to subsidize and keep farmers alive, which we should have done. That is more money. You may remember I got roundly criticized for being the guy in the administration insisting that we not let General Motors go under. And it cost almost twice as much as it did to bail out General Motors. And by the way, General Motors paid everything back. And those folks, those UAW workers, they took a gigantic hit to get it done. Now, but here's, we got $28 billion wasted debt, D-E-B-T, debt, because of this president's foolish, foolish trade policy. So you stop the stupid things that are happening, and you invest in the things that can generate additional employment. For example, we have 100,000 high-tech jobs out there that are going unfilled. Why? Because no one knows how to run a photovoltaic machine on a laboratory on a floor of a factory, or because we decided we're going to end the subsidy, we're going to end the tax credits for those folks making windmills. What are we doing? So investing many times will be the only thing we can do to generate economic growth. Look what happened in Detroit. President gave me all the great jobs. Get Detroit out of bankruptcy. I'm not joking. You may remember he gave me the authority to, the good news was when he gave me these jobs, he gave me presidential authority. So I was able to go and use every resource in the federal government to try to help them. Well, we went out and we put together a deal where we found all the money they were entitled to that they never claimed, and did everything from get light rail back to prevent street lights that had had effective lighting, et cetera. And everything was moving well. They got out of bankruptcy and moving. And guess what? We found out, not a joke, everybody who knew how to run a computer or program, whether a black, white, Asian, or whomever, left the city. No one knew how to turn on the streetlights. Not a joke. The streetlights. No one knew how to make the sewer system function. So we went to this international outfit. His name escapes me now. If you're going to hire somebody high-tech that you want to help with your computer systems and the like, and at the paper you'd go to. And so we hired them, went on and got them, and said, okay, help us find enough people who can train to be programmers. And so they went out, and it was, I think, a 19-week program. I think it was Dearborn Community College. Don't hold me to the community college. I can't remember now. And I went out for the graduation ceremony after 19 weeks where they taught people programming. It turned out every single person they got, wasn't intentional, they told me, was a woman. Most were women of color from the community, still lived in Detroit. Three quarters of them had a high school degree only, and a quarter had a GED. Every single one of them had a job, lowest starting paying job, $49,000, highest paying job, $104,000, just learning how to program. You do your banking on your cell phone. Guess what? We lost 100,000 tellers, but we're able to as a consequence of what was needed. You retired 30,000 people making almost 50% more than the teller makes because they're the ones now programming your phones and the banks. So we have to think about what is the future? Where are we going to increase productivity? How do we generate these jobs? I'm not saying I have all the answers, but I know the things we shouldn't be doing.
How are we doing on time? We started a bit late, so I'm wondering where we are on time.
We have 18 minutes left.
Okay, great. Great.
I'm supposed to go to a television thing shortly after this. I apologize.
No. You can spend your time with newspapers. You can forget the television. We're better to spend your time with.
I'm with you. Okay.
I'll ask this question because I promised my daughter, who is a college student, that I would ask it. She was very excited that we would be talking with you today. And I said, Amanda, and I told her I would mention her name, too, so I just did. I told her, Amanda, give me a question you would like me to ask the vice president that is a young person's question. What in your circle of people, your age, on your campus, What is most important to them? What do they talk about the most? What are they most interested in? And she said, and you could probably predict, it's climate change. So yes. that's getting a lot of attention among your competitors, and you talk about it, and Americans talk about it. The president, you mentioned he's in Switzerland, he called climate change advocates perennial prophets of doom. I'm wondering what your assessment of the issue of climate change is, how serious a problem you view climate change, and then how do we as a country address climate change without hurting jobs and our domestic economy?
Well, let me say two things. One, this has been an issue that I've been engaged in my whole career. I ran initially in 1972 on eventually setting up a Coastal Zone Act, which has prevented any development along the Delaware River and the estuaries because so many species were dying as we built factories along those areas. In 1987, I believe it was, and PolitiFact, as they say, you can check it, I went ahead and set up the first climate change bill that passed, and they said it was a game changer. The point is that it is the existential threat to humanity, and your daughter is absolutely correct. And so here's what I do. I believe this is, we're the only country in the world, and I know this sounds chauvinistic about America, but I believe it to be true. The only country in the world has ever been able to take great crises and turn them into incredible opportunities. Incredible opportunities. Think about after World War II, when all our allies were on the balls of their heels or in bankruptcy. What did we do? We came up with a plan. I didn't have anything to do with it. We came up with a plan that said we're going to, in effect, bail out Europe. We're going to spend billions of dollars rebuilding their economies. Think what that was. It was a disaster. But guess what? It provided enormous markets for us. We were the greatest beneficiary of all the change that took place by, and at the time, it was, oh, my God, everything's in chaos. I believe that we can get to a place where we get to net zero emissions by, and I know you hear people like, well, I won't mention it, say they get there by 2030. Find me a scientist in the world who thinks we can get to net zero emissions by 2030. It's going to take somewhere between 2045 and 2050 to get to net zero. But we can make significant, significant changes in the near term, creating, and the data shows this, well over 10 million good-paying jobs, not $15 an hour jobs, jobs making 40, 50, 60 bucks an hour with benefits, just like was happening in the factories that are set up in Iowa here, dealing with moving toward ethanol and hopefully. Other advances in ethanol. They're good-paying jobs. And we can bring down the pollution significantly. And one of the things I do is I call for and I lay out how we can do this. For example, as we, I've been a bit of a critic of the way in which we handle and move with damage that has occurred as a consequence of climate change, and whether or not we rebuild, what standard we rebuild to. We have to rebuild to the standard that science tells us already exists. And so, for example, every new infrastructure job we have out there should be a green job. We shouldn't be building any new highways that don't have charging stations. We could put 550,000 charging stations on our highways so we can own the electric vehicle market within the next 5 to 7 years. Period. Creating millions of good paying jobs. I sat down and the people who are most concerned about this are the union guys, whether they are the IBW or all these, what are we going to do? And you lay out exactly what can be done and what will be done. So, for example, I incentivize technologies. I give tax credits to homeowners to install energy-efficient technologies like Energy Star windows, and which are made here, by the way, by Pella. Extending and expanding the tax credits for purchase of electric vehicles, credits for production of advanced biofuels so they can be used on planes and ships and lower carbon footprints. You know, just go down the line. Credits, for example, for battery technology. I met with some of the folks in Silicon Valley. I said, look, you guys are awful good about talking about how you're changing all the technology in the world here, but what are you doing to make sure people can adjust to it and they can have jobs? And they, I was introduced to one outfit that is now making home battery systems that can store renewable power, whether it's solar or whether it is sun. We have to work on, and we have the wherewithal to do it, invest in dealing with the transmission of wind and solar. We don't have a transmission system across our country to do it. Smart infrastructure, look, you got to remember, we're 15% of the problem. The rest of the world is 85% of the problem. I was part of the deal and my team as vice president to put together the Paris Climate Accord. We got over 200 nations just under 200 nations signed on to that. Now, we walked away from it, and we've lost all our moral authority to deal with this. So what I'm going to do as president, not a joke, on day one, we're going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, and I'm going to summon 160 to 190 nations to the United States, just like we did dealing with the whole issue of nuclear proliferation, and sit and say, we all made a pledge that we would deal with the science as it dictates. And that means the following. And those countries that don't participate and do not or try to skirt it, they will face international sanctions relating to their trade. So, for example, if China continues to sell tens of millions of tons of coal on their Belt and Road prospect by exporting this pollution, then, in fact, they're not going to be able to trade and do things around the world because the rest of the world is going to deal with it. And so there's a lot of, for example, right now, think of what we need, the international leadership. If any one of you were president, I'll lay you 8 to 5, you'd be doing what I'm about to say. You have the largest carbon sink in the world in the Amazon. I'm the guy, along with Richard Lugar, that years ago said, we will trade you debt for forest. You don't cut down your forest, you don't expand. We will forgive you debt we owe you, that you owe us, if you, in fact, maintain, we didn't call them then, carbon sinks. You'll absorb it from the air. So what's happening now? More carbon is absorbed on a daily and yearly basis into the Amazon, out of the atmosphere, getting us closer to less emissions than all of the vehicles in the United States of America on a yearly basis. Every single solitary vehicle. More. Now, what are we doing? It came along and said, we should be organizing the world. This is what I mean about international leadership. We should be the ones bringing the world together and saying, we will provide not $2 billion, but $20 to $25 billion internationally to them to make up for their, provide other job opportunities for them, rather than have them to erase what is a world gem that the world needs. And that is that carbon sink. But that takes international leadership. That takes leadership by only one outfit can do that, the United States of America. And so there's a whole range of things that I would do. Now, the last thing I'll mention is, you know, I propose for, in my proposal, that I'm talking about investing $1.7 trillion over 10 years. Well, the key to that is the $400 billion money that invest in the first 10 relating to research and development. We should be the net exporters of those things that, in fact, can absorb and or change the environment in a way that we're absorbing carbon out of the air. We're dealing with methane. For example, in the first day of my administration, and this is not a joke, I will go back to making sure that we eliminate all, literally all, of the executive orders that Trump used to curtail the EPA's authority and our deals we had made. If we just go back to the mileage standards we call for, that eliminates 12 billion barrels of oil. 12 billion barrels of oil. And the automobile companies understand they got to move that direction anyway. They didn't oppose it. They opposed him changing it. And so there's a lot of practice. Every single, the largest owner of vehicles in the world is the federal government. Every one of them, every one of them will be running on biofuels. Every single solitary one of them. I was asked to head up that $900 billion, turns out to be over more than almost $960 billion in the recovery package, which I was able to get three Republicans to vote for to get it passed. And we invested more money in renewable energy, $100 billion, to make sure we, in fact, brought down made the cost of solar and wind competitive with coal, so that no one's going to build a new coal-fired plant in America because it makes no sense. But we have to continue to deal with the job. And so if we continue to provide these exceptions for biofuel and not moving to cellulosics and other fuels, then we're just biting our nose off to spite our face. We can create good jobs, reduce and get ourselves off the carbon binge, deal with methane, my state's like yours. Delaware, the largest industry in the Delmarva Peninsula is agriculture. I know you guys are very prideful. You're the big deal.
We are the big deal.
$4 billion okay? Almost as big as you guys. But guess what? It's chickens and soybeans. And the chickens generate an awful lot of manure. And we're polluting the Chesapeake Bay. You guys are worried about polluting the Mississippi Delta. Well, guess what? There's a technology available now to learn how to pelletize all of this manure, take the methane out of it, be able to use it for energy, generate small factories that, in fact, can bag this stuff as fertilizer, and it is not a pollution. It is not ruining the environment and the water supplies. I mean, these are practical things that can be done, but we got to stop being climate deniers.
Oh. I'm sorry, we're at about time, so we're going to have to wrap.
Well, no, I'll try to answer yes or no if you have a few more questions.
I had one more I wanted to slip in if we have time for that.
She's right.
The question relates to guns. I've seen the Unite Our Country PAC ad multiple times, and I wanted to know what additional steps you advocate the country take with respect to guns and gun control.
Well, first of all, I think a president of the United States has to explain to the American people, including gun owners, in clear terms what we're doing. Number one, I believe the Second Amendment is real. And I believe, for example, I have a 20-gauge shotgun and a 12-gauge shotgun. I'm not a hunter, but I clay pigeons and the like. My sons eat my deceased son bow. They duck hunt and like anyway. So I'm not opposed to people being able to have a firearm. But there's two things I feel strongly about, and everybody, you understand, but everybody has to understand. Number one, nothing about any one of the amendments is absolute. You cannot yell fire in a crowded movie theater. There are limitations what constitutes speech. From the very beginning, we've been able to, under the Second Amendment, decide who can own a weapon and what kind of weapon can be owned. From the 32 or 34 Firearms Act that was passed, we made it clear that there were certain weapons back then you could not own. You can't own a machine gun. You can't own a flamethrower. And by the way, those in your state and mine, and I've confronted them both in both states, that talk about the tree of liberty is water with the blood of patriots, they better be able to get an Apache helicopter with Hellfire missiles if they think they're going to protect themselves, or an F-15, protect themselves against the government. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. And so I strongly believe that what the vast majority of gun owners, over 95% of gun owners and members of the NRA agree, there should be background checks. I'm the guy that put through the Brady Bill while even some of my own party were voting against extending, providing the Brady Bill and background checks. We must have background checks, number one, and they must be tightened. And number two, there are certain weapons that make no sense. And when I was trying to get this passed, which I got passed now 15 years ago, was, or longer than that, I guess it was 95, elimination of the amount of, the number of rounds you can have in a magazine and what kind of weapon you can own. We eliminated assault weapons, and we, in fact, limited the number of weapons, of bullets you can have in a magazine. Because, and so I go, and the way I campaign in Delaware is like most of your folks out here campaign. You go into the areas where people live. You get, you know, I walked through what the estuaries where a lot of people fish in my set. And I'd say, God darn, Joe, you're taking away my gun. And I'd show them a picture, not a joke. Show them a picture of an AR-15 or, you know, any of the assault weapons. And I'd say, you need one of these, man? Well, no, damn, Joe, I don't need that. I'd go to gun shows in my state. Well, no, I don't need that. I don't need that. And I'd say, now let me tell you, you need a magazine with 40 rounds in it? You must be a lousy damn hunter, man. You're a danger to yourself. You think you should be able to have 100 rounds in a magazine? Come on, man. They were even opposed, the NRA even opposed my ban on cop killer bullets, Teflon tip bullets. I'd go in and say, how many deer are you hunting wearing a Kevlar vest, fella? You must be one lousy hunter. And so what's happened is, if you go in and explain to people that what you're doing is not confiscating their shotgun, not putting them in a position where they, in fact, cannot continue to hunt, et cetera, 30-07 or whatever else they're going to hunt with, depending what they're hunting, that you, in fact, though, have to pass a background check. And, number two, you cannot have a magazine with more than 10 rounds in it. If you do need one, by the way, you really are a lousy hunter. And thirdly, we protect, for example, international flight of geese more than we do people. You can't go out and hunt, if any of you guys are hunters. You can't go out with more than 3 shells in a shotgun. 3, T-H-R-E-E. Because we've got to give the geese a chance.
Well,
come on.
Mr. Vice President, I think the reason a lot of hunters, though, and gun owners are worried is there are a lot of proposals on your party's side to ban semi-automatic weapons, which they're some of the most popular hunting weapons are that caliber, and also, of course, handguns, which people use to defend themselves in their homes. So I guess where would you draw the line? Where would you draw the line as far as? I'm sorry.
You realize more people get shot with their own weapon in their home by an intruder than ever shoot an intruder. You know that, right? That's a fact. As my wife, the professor, said, Google it. That's a fact. You have to learn how to kill somebody. It doesn't come easy. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I would just say, where would you, when you talk about which weapons the people shouldn't have, where would you draw the line when it comes to semi-automatics?
I would draw the line as whether or not to how many rounds you can have in that weapon. How many rounds? And you cannot be in a situation. Look, the majority of people are killed in these mass shootings within the first 20 seconds. And that requires a gun that can fire a whole hell of a lot of rounds at one time. There's no need for that. If you need a semi-automatic weapon to go hunt, you're a lousy hunter. Tell me where you need one of those.
All that means is one bullet for each pull of the trigger, as I understand.
Yeah,
is
no, the definition, I agree. But my point is, the semi-automatic weapon is you're able to hold down the trigger too. So it depends on what you're meaning by semi-automatic.
Yes.
But it gets back to the rounds. Look at all the mass shootings. I'll conclude with this. Look, you talk about the soul of the nation. Think of what the hell happened between where your daughter went to school, if she's in college. She went to school and she learned how to drop, roll, and cover, because in case there was a fire. We sent our kids off to school, first, second, third, fourth grade, learning how to duck and cover. What a morally bankrupt country. A morally bankrupt country. That the NRA owns the White House, or the gun manufacturers own the White House now. Think about it.
Think about the anxiety. You realize that the one, I spent a lot of times, I was speaking in London, the International Association of Psychiatry, as well as the American Association. I forget the exact title, but the, you know, their national outfit. You know, the one generation in America that has the greatest sense of anxiety and mental and concerns about mental insecurity? The Z generation, 7 to 17 years old. Check it out with the guy up at Harvard who does the study. I can't think of his name now. I'll have the staff get it to you. They did this survey in the beginning of this past year. What is the greatest concern? I mean, beginning of 19. What is the greatest concern people have, kids have, who are in grade school and high school? You know what it is? On a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being intense, it is getting shot in school. Think about that, guys.
All right, thanks, guys. Brett.
Anyway, I'm sorry to take so much of your time.
No, we want to say, before we wrap up, we appreciate your time, sir. You were supposed to be here in person. That didn't work out. We appreciate the fact you carved out an hour for us this morning to make up for that. We enjoyed the discussion, and we sincerely appreciate your time.
Well, I sincerely appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I get to see you again. Thanks. Talk to you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.